to our third week. I'm going to begin with a trip that actually takes us way back in time. If you followed your bookmark things, it will say today is the comparison of Jesus and Moses, and it certainly is. But I'm first going to take us back quite a ways into Genesis, when we're introduced to the first mentioned Hebrew in the Bible, and that's in Genesis 14:13. And the verse says, "The one who escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew." This particular story dealt with the kidnapping of Lot, Abram's nephew, Abram's rescue of him, and others who had been captured during this raid. And after Abram's successful rescue mission, a certain priest named Melchizedek made his first appearance as well. In the very next chapter and following chapters, God makes a covenant with Abram. And why I go back that far, I'm going to quickly read to you from A Christian's Pocket Guide to Loving the Old Testament by Alec Moyer. And what he says is, the Lord sketched out to Abraham that covenant membership carried life implications with it in Genesis 17:1. But the requirement was left undeveloped, because in the Lord's intended scheme, the giving of the detailed law was reserved for Moses at Sinai. We can think of the whole historical movement from Egypt to Sinai to Canaan as a gigantic visual aid. According to Exodus 6:7, the Lord's purpose and promise was to take you as my people and I will be my God. More than was involved in simple liberation from Egypt, the covenant relationship was to be established. Not only, therefore, would he free them from Egypt, he would redeem them. And this is what had happened at the Passover. The Lord had sent the 9 plagues on the Egyptians to maneuver them into obedience. They failed their prohibition. A new situation had to be faced. And the dread of the 10th plague was completely different. Previous, the Lord had sent plagues, but this time it was, I will go out into the midst of Egypt. I will pass through the land of Egypt. I will execute judgment. When the Lord himself comes to judge, it is no longer Israel's relation to Pharaoh that matters, but how they will fare in the day of divine judgment. Grace is not specifically mentioned, but surely it was divine grace which provided the sheltering blood which kept Israel safe on the Passover night. Before Passover, they could not leave Egypt, and after Passover, they couldn't stay. As the Lord's redeemed pilgrim people, they set out for the promised land, led by the great pillar of cloud and fire by Moses. So they were conducted not to Canaan, but to Sinai. Are you interpreting the visual aid? Egypt first, then Sinai. Passover first, then the giving of the law. The divine work of grace first, then the life of responsive obedience. Redemption and salvation first, then walking with God in his appointed way of holiness. So with that as our backdrop, I'm now going to skip us back ahead 1,500 years approximately to the time to when this letter to the Hebrews was being written. Hebrews is a smallish book, just 13 chapters, just 303 verses. We're not focusing on the author because he's not mentioned, and so we're just not going to worry about that. We are looking at the original recipients of this letter being Jewish converts, and I'm saying original because the letter still has value for us as well. And these original recipients were going through some persecution, some trials that was causing them to drift from the faith that they had in Jesus. They were under a pressure to abandon their faith and return back to the legalism and law that they had been used to following. They were under pressure to drop this Jesus stuff, per se, and just go back to what they knew. Stop making, you know, everybody else uncomfortable, and just go back to what we know, to what we have known for a long time. And the author is going to show them over and over that Jesus is superior to anything that they are going to be tempted to abandon him for. And thus it will start with the comparison. In the ESV and King James Study Bible, their little notes or prelims say that this letter is written with a persuasive language that is partly argumentative, and it's similar to a debate. The author is repeating the main idea, as you will hear me, that Jesus is better often, but he does it from a variety of angles. I'd like to go to Hebrews chapter 3 and just read those first six verses quickly. Therefore, holy brothers, you who share in heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession, who is faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses also was faithful in all God's house. For Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of a house has more honor than the house itself. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant to testify to the things that were to be spoken later. But Christ is faithful over God's house as a son. And we are his house if indeed we hold fast our confidence and boasting in hope. So we see in those six verses that Jesus is better than the angels, Moses, the tabernacle, all these things that were the foundations of the Mosaic law. And then he closes even there, and what continues on for the rest of this week's reading through 4:13, the exhortation for the Christian and how to hold fast. We see in this argument that Jesus is better from Moses. And the end purpose of this book is to establish who Jesus is and for the reader to receive encouragement to not abandon their faith. They were being exhorted to see that the current suffering that they were genuinely enduring was going to be followed by eternity and eternal glory with Jesus. And that was something that the original Judaism had not offered them. And what I want us to see and to grasp with our hearts and minds is that the Old Testament in its entirety pointed to one direction, and that is Jesus. And Moses probably would have been the first one to tell you that. If you participated in the read-through last year, even if you're just vaguely familiar with Old Testament words like offerings, feasts, tabernacles, priests, and for some of us that might cause a little bit of an eye twitch in memory of the detail as we read those words over and over and over, that they were set in place and used to show us, it took the whole Old Testament to get there, but the better way of Jesus. The temporal covenants had been replaced by a new eternal one, the price of which had been paid in full by the blood of Christ. We see and will continue to see the key words of sacrifice and better. The sacrifice of Jesus is revealed to be better, in fact, superior than anything the Judaic system had to offer. For those of us who might scratch our heads saying, but wasn't that God's plan? Wasn't it God who instituted that? And the answer is yes, of course. But it was just the beginning plan. It was the step in the foundation of the fulfillment that again led to Jesus. It was a plan that couldn't work. God knew that. But being a faithful and merciful God, he shows us his way and then lets us see our need for him. So just as last week, we saw how Jesus was better than the angels. Today, we're going to focus more on how he is better than Moses. I wanted quickly, before we get into that, to do some similarities of Moses and Jesus that are really pretty profound. At the time when Moses was born, the Egyptians ruled over the Israelites. And at the time when Jesus was born, the Romans ruled over the Israelites. Both Moses and Jesus were born when the Hebrew nation was occupied and at a low point in history. Pharaoh had ordered all the Hebrew sons to be killed upon birth during Moses' time. And King Herod, after finding out about this king of the Jews, had ordered that all the Hebrew sons were to be killed up to the age of two. When Moses was born, his mother hid him for 3 months in Egypt. After Jesus' birth, he was taken and hidden in Egypt for an unspecified amount of time before God gave the release to Joseph to bring them back out. Moses was raised by a man, Pharaoh, who was not his natural father. Jesus was raised by Joseph, also a man who was not his natural father. Moses liberated the Hebrews so that they could serve God. Jesus liberated mankind so that mankind may serve God. Moses used the blood of a lamb to protect the Israelites from death, and the blood was also used to free the Israelites from bondage. Jesus was the Lamb of God who protected mankind from death, and his blood was also used to free mankind from the bondage of sin. Moses used a covenant meal, the Passover, for Israel to remember the Lord's deliverance. Jesus used a covenant meal, the Last Supper, for his disciple to remember their Lord's deliverance. Moses sprinkled the blood of the first covenant on the people in Exodus 24:8. Jesus used the blood of the new covenant, his own blood, to sanctify the people. Moses interceded with God on behalf of the people of Israel. Jesus interceded with God on behalf of mankind, fulfilling the prophecy of Isaiah 53:12 by being the final sacrifice for sin. Moses' brothers criticized and challenged him. We know that Jesus was criticized and challenged as well. Moses made a serpent on a pole, and the Israelites were healed when they looked upon it. Jesus was lifted up high on a cross, and those who looked upon him by faith are healed. Moses was a shepherd of God's people, and Jesus called himself the Good Shepherd. Those are some of the similarities, and actually not really any of those come into the comparisons of how Jesus is better than Moses. And I want to point out that the comparisons are not between equal things. The author argues from the lesser to the greater, and the emphasis throughout is on Jesus, who was and is better than everything. The two themes of who Christ is and what we as Christians need to believe and put into practice actually have a connection. It is because of who Jesus is and what he has done that gives us what we need to persevere to get to our promised land. And I hope, time willing, to be able to touch on that a little bit more. But we are not, as the ancient Hebrews were so in danger of, to place our hopes on religious practices that cannot save us. And here's the thing, that is something that Israel modeled brilliantly for us. We don't see a good result ever coming for any length of time by following all the rules and the laws. And the thing is, there wasn't anything wrong with the rules and the laws. It's the heart of man. The Old Testament itself is a series of foreshadowing that the book of Hebrews explains in detail how the atonement of Christ constitutes the actual story, if you will. He is the reality behind the shadows. So, Jesus versus Moses. As I mentioned earlier, God's covenant was with Abraham, was carried down to Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Jacob's family, moved where Joseph was living in Egypt, another story that was orchestrated beautifully by God. 400 years later, it's time to go, and who's going to lead these Hebrews out of Egypt? It's Moses. I want to focus for a bit on Moses and who he was to the Jewish nation so we can even really grasp why it has to be said that Jesus is better than him. Obviously, to us modern-day Christians, we've grown up knowing the completed, fully accessible Bible, so we have the benefit from the get-go of knowing who Jesus is and how he is better. And that's been established, you know, for over 2,000 years. But for those who were on the receiving end of the letter of Hebrews, they were steeped in the life and history of the patriarchs and of Moses. The covenant that Moses had mediated through Moses was well known. It was life to them, and it had been for a long time. Jesus, at the time of this letter, he still knew. We're saying this letter is written, you know, late 60s AD. So it hasn't even been a century for the time of Jesus. And he is technically going up against a system that's been in place for about 1500 or, you know, a long, long time. I did try to look up dates to see, you know, Abraham was born approximately 1946 BC, Moses 1526 BC, and then Jesus is born almost 1400 years later. But I got confused because so many dates, you know, they varied by a year or two, and I realized that wasn't my point, was the actual dates. My point was to establish that the Jews had been following circumcision and the Mosaic law for a long, long time. That is why, in God's grace and goodness, he's reminding them and recalling them to whose they are now. God was the author of the law they had been following, the one who instituted circumcision. Now he's called them to something permanent, something different, and he is making sure they don't get tangled up and lost along the way. The nation of Israel has gone through, again, as we've read and read, many ups and downs. They lived in the promised land. They lived in exile. The thing that had been a permanent, regardless of where they were, was the Ten Commandments, circumcision, and the law they knew. The very Israelites who grumbled against Moses continually in the wilderness, their descendants are now the ones who revere him greatly and are going to grumble against the better Moses, Jesus. And remember what I was talking about earlier, that religious practices cannot save us. I want us to again remember that for these early Christians, it's what they knew. And it even caused me to think, how easy is it for me as a Christian, for us as a community of believers, to still want to have religious practices that make us better, that make us more like God or bring us closer to God? It's a very easy mindset to get trapped into, that if I just do this, this, and this, if I only would this. And the thing is it's again, there's nothing wrong following the Ten Commandments. By all means, follow the Ten Commandments. The point is that is not going to make you worthy of the promised land. It's not going to make you worthy in and of yourself of this eternal destination that Jesus is calling you to. It is not going to make you able to endure in the present world in which we live. We need Jesus. The Israelites needed Jesus. The world continues to need Jesus. You can rule us up and law us up all you want. Our innate nature is to fight and to rebel. Even if what we know is good for us, even if what we know is best for us, These Israelites were no different. And here's the thing. They were looking at God's law as the path to get to God. And now they've been told, no, it's Jesus. That's a lot. That, I mean, I never really did in the past. I felt for them that they had all these years this nice little succinct way of do this, do that, sacrifice this, sacrifice that, let everybody see the outside wash. And now they're being circumcised differently. They're being circumcised in their heart. They're being told it's nothing to do with you and how you behave. It's all about Jesus. And I think they're probably thinking, let's give that old law a try again. I feel like, you know, maybe we can do that. Sometimes I find that God, Jesus, is so freeing that it's scary. Because then, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to earn it? How do I show God what a good girl I am? Through Jesus. Every time it comes back to Jesus. Okay. So we're going to enter now the Jesus that they're trying to hold on to. Jesus and his New Testament, his birth, his life, his ministry, his death, and his resurrection aren't anything like what they had seen from the Old Testament prophecies. They weren't looking for a man to be born to a poor carpenter in a manger and not come and take over the world. They weren't looking for a humble man to walk among them and not be glorious. They weren't looking for anything like who Jesus was. The recipients of the Hebrews' letter were now having to be reminded, as I think sometimes we are too, the name of Jesus brings to mind the New Testament. But Jesus is from before. He's from the beginning. And these people needed to be shown that Jesus wasn't just around for 33 years on earth as God as man. He had been around from the beginning. And you know what? He was a whole heck of a lot better than Moses. All right, so the letter to the Hebrews is being written. We know, because I keep saying it over and over, that Jesus is better than everything, and he's going to continue to be everything. Better than everything that we're going to read about in the chapters ahead. We also know, because I keep mentioning the Mosaic Law and the Ten Commandments, I do want to say that Jesus did fulfill the law completely, something no one had been able to do and no one would be able to do after him. He fulfilled every bit of it. Something people had been trying to do since it had been instituted and failing miserably. Jesus had done it. That alone sets him apart from Moses. Jesus fulfilled the law completely. John Piper says that there are two ways that Jesus is superior to Moses, which is mentioned in 3:2-6. And what strengthens our confidence and our hope is not just the raw fact of Jesus' superiority over Moses, it's what we see about Jesus that makes him superior. Seeing Jesus in a fresh way in this text, is what helps us hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end, from verse 6. Both Jesus and Moses were faithful in God's house. We see the comparison first before the contrast. We are told they were both faithful. The author isn't at any point speaking negatively about Moses, just as he wasn't speaking negatively about angels, just as he won't be speaking negatively about future things that we are going to compare Jesus to. It isn't speaking negatively about Moses. Moses was faithful. He was in a league of his own. Numbers 12, 6 through 8. It might have been clever to mark that. And this is coming after Miriam and Aaron are tired of Moses stealing all their thunder. It says, "And the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent," I've gone back to five, "and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forward. And he said, 'Hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. Not so my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly and not in riddles, and he beholds the form of the Lord. Why were you then not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?'" This isn't a degradation of Moses. It's showing who he was and how he was in God's house. And then that they should be amazed that Jesus is even better than that. Ezekiel 14, 14 and Jeremiah 15, 1, there are Moses shout-outs as well, as those prophets are portraying what will happen and saying that even if Moses, as well as some other select company, I think it's Job and Daniel and Samuel, I believe, that even if they were called in, God wouldn't turn back what he's about to do. It's showing Moses in a light of great, great favor with God. And I want to say in a different way, it's not even a competition between Jesus and Moses. It's not a money fight. Jesus is better. Why? Because he's God. Moses doesn't stand a chance against that, nor should he. He had a specific purpose for a specific time, and he fulfilled that. He did what was asked of him. Just as we have a specific purpose for a specific space and time, we are to fulfill that. But in no way are any of the things that we're going to do, certainly, I don't even think, compared to Moses, but by any stretch are they going to compare to Jesus. Moses is painted in the best light possible. He simply pales in comparison to Jesus. And it reminds me of the story of, and I had meant to get the reference, but I didn't, of Moses asking God to see his glory. Show me your glory. Jesus is God's glory. Jesus doesn't have to ask God, show me your glory. He is, from chapter 1, the radiance of the glory of God. And just finally, Moses was the serpent. Jesus is the son. I'm going to skip just a little bit ahead. Christ is God's full and final revelation, and he by far surpasses the limited preliminary revelation that was given in the Old Testament. The New American Standard Bible Study Note said, "The prophecies and promises of the Old Testament are fulfilled in the New Covenant, the New Testament, of which Christ is the mediator. From the Old Testament itself, Christ is shown to be superior than what? Ancient prophets, angels, Moses, who was the mediator of the former covenant." What we are not going to have time to get into in the rest of this week's reading is the exhortation to the people that there can be no turning back to the old system, old Jewish system. Once you come to know the truth of Christ, God's people now must look only to Jesus, whose atoning death, resurrection, and ascension have opened the way into God's presence. We must resist the temptation to give up, or we risk finding ourselves meeting with the same judgment as the rebellious generation of Israelites did in the desert. I wanted to quickly, as we close up, go into the rest of this week's reading talked about the Israelites and their rebellion in the desert and why they didn't go. And why that is being brought up and in is the author wants current day Christians then and now to see the stakes for the Israelites to not go into the promised land at that time virtually was death. For us, it's eternity with Christ. The stakes are much higher than they were with Moses. And so the author is adjuring them, don't turn from Jesus, from what you have been given, because you've got nothing left to go back to. There's no Egypt. There's nothing. Once you have tasted and seen who Jesus is, there's no return. And his love, his care for this people who are being caught up in the struggle is beautiful, because it's showing that God gets where their frustration is coming from. He gets this. And so I'm now just going to say that we also can be in a wilderness-like environment where we have to trust God for future rest in his new creation. And a final thought that I kind of hate to drop in your lap, but I feel I would be remiss if I didn't, that so much of what Israel had went through was because of unbelief and disobeying God. And that is the very thing the author of Hebrews is admonishing this generation. Don't get into unbelief. That stems disobedience. Disobedience stems further unbelief. He's calling them to the high standard that only can be found in Jesus. But again, the work was done through Jesus. He's not asking anything of them that he hasn't already provided a way for. That's a sad ending to an actual powerful event. But so I'm going to read quickly. So, and this is from Bruce Lindsay. It says, so God, in bringing Israel to a promised land, which was an earthly temporary installment of that rest, was to be fully restored one day. The promised land was a type, a figure, a symbol that pointed ahead to a more substantial reality that God would accomplish through his coming Messiah. This is the point that the writer of Hebrews picks up on when he says that out of this was certainly David's understanding, since he wrote about the possibility of entering God's rest long after the days of Joshua and Moses. God's rest. We'll find it only in Jesus. I would like to pray. Father, I thank you that it's in you that we find our rest, that it's in Jesus that we find everything we need. I thank you that Jesus is better than Moses, that he's better than the angels, that he's better than everything that you had yet set into motion. I thank you that he is God. I thank you for these words that can direct us and show us how to follow you, how to trust in you, how to not abandon the faith, and to hold fast to that which we know. I pray that you would be with these ladies as they go out and face this week. May you hold them fast and keep them close. In Jesus' name, amen.